another lecture, which will be leading by the our distinguished guest, Yossi Klein Halevi, whom you perfectly know. Yes, please welcome him. And the subject, it's not enough to say title, it's absolutely, I mean, it's such a, okay, the title sounds like a how, not why, how Poland changed my life. I know how Israel changed my life. I know how the Jewish world changed my life, but I really cannot understand how Poland could change the life of this gentleman who lives in Jerusalem, and you know, he's so involved and dedicated his life to the process of reconciliation between the Jews, Muslims, and the Christians. How Poland, I guess I know, but how Poland, changed his life. I'm more than curious, and I will thank you from the bottom of my heart for accepting our invitation. And Yossi, it's a great pleasure. You are the light of this festival, and thank you. And I can promise you that next year we'll meet again with Yossi Klein Halevi, who is the member of our common Neshpuche, Polish, Jewish, Israeli Neshpuche. So thank you so much. And Yossi Klein Halevi, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you. Janosz, thank you. Dziękuję. Dzień dobry. Shalom. Good afternoon. What I would like to try to do this afternoon is answer your question, Janosz. And to tell you something about experiencing those moments in history that I would call messianic. Moments in history where suddenly there's an opening, a rupture in the normal course of events, and suddenly we can glimpse a different reality, or at least the potential for a different reality. We can glimpse the possibility of a different course for humanity, and the possibility in transforming what we call, with a kind of a sad resignation, the way of the world or human nature. And in my life, I experienced two such messianic ruptures in history. And I would argue that the people who lived through those two moments knew at the time that they were living through not just extraordinary moments, but really redemptive moments, moments that had the possibility of transforming reality. The first moment was the summer of 1967. I was 14 years old, and the Six-Day War had just happened in Israel, and Israel had gone from experiencing the fears of destruction in May 1967 to the euphoria of the greatest military victory that the Jewish people ever experienced. And my father, who was a Holocaust survivor from Hungary and had two brothers who had survived the war who were living in Israel, I grew up, as you can hear, in the U.S., my father immediately after the war said, "That's it, we're getting on a plane and we're going to Israel." Now, in those years, those of you who are my contemporaries will recall that airplane travel was very rare, not only from communist countries where it was impossible, but even in the West, it was quite rare. And we got on a plane, we flew to Israel, and the summer of 1967 was really Israel's summer of love. And there was the summer of love happening in San Francisco at the same time. It was also happening in Jerusalem. And experiencing that sense of Jewish family and that sense of celebrating a moment where we suddenly realized that we were the victors of history, that we were the generation that was privileged to see that turn in Jewish history. that moment changed my life, certainly, and I think the lives of many in my generation. And eventually I moved to Israel because of that experience of the summer of 67. But what I would like to speak to you about today is really the second redemptive moment that I experienced, that second moment of a rupture in history, which was the fall of 1989. And the fall of 1989, I was 35, something like that, and working as a journalist, by then already living in Israel. I had moved to Israel in 1982. And I was spending the year fortuitously in Europe. My wife and I decided to just take a break and spend a year in France, actually. And we got there in the summer of 1989, and suddenly strange things were happening in Europe, in Hungary, and then in Poland. Solidarity takes over. I think it was September 1989, and this is the first time where a communist regime is unseated and a democratic Poland is reborn. And 30 years ago, and this is the 30th anniversary of the rebirth of a free Poland, the rebirth of a free Eastern and Central Europe, and the fall of Soviet communism, which is actually a moment that I think we came to take for granted, at least in the West, we came to take for granted much too quickly. That extraordinary moment when the world's most powerful totalitarian empire in history, 70-year totalitarian empire, suddenly gave up, suddenly surrendered, more or less peacefully, and disappeared. And when the more that I think back to that moment, the only word that I can use to describe that as a religious person is a miracle. And I mean miracle in a very literal, God-centered way. And whatever plans I had for that year in France quickly changed. And I began as a journalist to follow the falling Soviet dominoes. I started in Poland. I came in October 1989. Then I went to Berlin. I was there when the wall fell. And in Prague for the Velvet Revolution. And following the progression of history as miracle. And for me, 1967, the summer of 1967 and the fall of 1989 are now linked in my consciousness as moments of such intense possibility that I have, despite the fact of living in Israel for the last 35 years, despite experiencing what we've experienced in Israel, the wars, the intifadas, the collapse of the peace process, I remain a hopeless optimist about the future of humanity. Now, seen from 2019, this will all seem a little bit surreal. Because we're in one of those moments in history which are, I would call, really anti-messianic. All over the world, it's a very bad time. It's a very bad time for Polish-Jewish relations, but it's a very bad time in general. And when I think about what 1989 meant for Europe and what 1967 meant for Israel, and I look at where, just take our two countries and see where we are at this moment, it is enough to lose heart and to make one wonder about the fleeting nature of these redemptive moments. And so what I would like to do with you this afternoon is go back to the fall of 1989 and speak about moments of possibility, and remind ourselves what that particular opening represented. And I'd like to do so from a personal perspective. I'd like to speak to you how 1989 in Poland changed me. And yes, Janusz, I'm speaking to you. And 1989, fall of 89, Solidarity is victorious, and the first Prime Minister, Mazowiecki, comes from the liberal wing of the Polish Church. And it was a moment that was really a precursor of the sudden empowerment of the liberal opposition to communism all over Eastern and Central Europe. Havel in Prague and even in Hungary, it's hard to imagine today, but in Hungary the leadership that took over immediately after communism actually came from the liberal opposition. But what drew me to Poland at that moment, and it's really a little embarrassing to say, but I came to Poland as a journalist, not to report on this extraordinary moment, but to report on one of those bad moments in Polish-Jewish relations, which was the Auschwitz convent. For those of you who were too young to remember, the Auschwitz convent was a convent of Carmelite nuns who moved into an abandoned building in Auschwitz I, and I'll explain soon why I'm emphasizing Auschwitz I, and began praying for the souls that had been murdered in the camp. And in the Jewish world, this was taken almost unanimously as an assault on Jewish history and Jewish memory. And the way that this was experienced by Jews was that you Poles, not only didn't you do anything to try to save Jews during the war, which of course is a more complicated issue than I've just presented, but in the Jewish consciousness, certainly at that moment, not only did you Poles do nothing to save the Jews, but now you're trying to retroactively claim their souls and as if you're trying to somehow appropriate the Holocaust and turn the Holocaust into a Polish event. That was virtually normative in the Jewish world. That was how the convent was experienced, as an assault on the integrity of Jewish memory. The Polish position, as I was to learn that fall, was exactly the opposite. This is an event that didn't only happen to the Jews. We Poles, have our victims. In Auschwitz I, 70,000 of the Polish spiritual, intellectual, religious elite were murdered. And this is our land, this happened on our soil, and we have every right to pray for the souls of the people who were murdered here, from our people. So you had two completely opposite ways of understanding the same experience. And it really is, if one wants a blueprint for everything that goes wrong in Polish-Jewish relations, the Auschwitz convent is a wonderful place to start. I came shortly after a group of American Jews had scaled the wall of the convent, wearing Jewish prayer shawls, and made a sit-in demonstration inside the courtyard of the convent. And so it was the most heated moment in Polish-Jewish relations, certainly in these last decades. And when I came here, I suddenly realized that I had come for the wrong story. That the real story was the defeat of the beginning of the defeat of the Soviet Union. Now, of course, in the fall of 1989, we didn't know to what extent the defeat would actually be like. We didn't know that what had begun here in 1989 would end in 1991 with the final surrender of Soviet communism. But we began to see the beginning of the end. You could feel that the Soviet Union was in chaotic retreat. And suddenly what I felt, and this took me completely by surprise, was a sense of shared joy, of victory between the Jewish people and the Polish people. Because the great enemy for both of our peoples in the post-World War II era was the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union, I don't have to tell Poles what the Soviet Union meant to me, but to remind the Jews in the audience, the Soviet Union was the center for state-organized anti-Semitism after Nazi Germany. Anti-Zionism, the anti-Zionism that we know today, ideological anti-Zionism as a cover for anti-Semitism, was invented in Moscow in the 1960s and 70s as one more tool in the assault against Soviet Jewry and against the State of Israel. The Soviet Union, of course, was the greatest supporter of Palestinian terrorism and of the Arab world's wars against Israel. And so I come to Poland, and I'm feeling this shared joy as a Jew. And I'll add one more personal element, which is that I grew up in the Soviet Jewry protest movement in New York of the 1960s and 70s. That was really my youth. What my youth was spent, and I'm not exaggerating too much, my youth was spent outside in the streets before the Soviet UN mission in New York and the Soviet embassy in Washington. And I went with a group of friends in 1973 to Moscow, and we had a sit-in in the Soviet emigration office. And so my whole activism, my whole political youth was really spent in opposition to the Soviet Union. And I come here, and I'm feeling this sense of shared liberation. And the Jews in the Soviet Union are beginning to emigrate to Israel. This is all happening around the same time. The doors are opening. And of course, eventually a million and a half Soviet Jews move to Israel. And so, and it's interesting, you know, I when I was here, I suddenly remembered an incident from one of our demonstrations in New York, one of the anti-Soviet demonstrations. We were marching toward the Soviet mission, and suddenly there was a group of Polish Americans who were also marching against the Soviet mission at the same time, and these two groups converged. It was December 1970. I remember the date vividly because it was the Leningrad trial for Jews. I think some of you will remember. It was a group of Soviet Jews who tried to hijack a plane to Israel. It was really the big moment in the Soviet Jewry protest movement. And there is a group of Polish Americans who were demonstrating because there were demonstrations in Gdansk at the same time. And so suddenly there's this convergence, and I remember seeing a Polish flag and an Israeli flag briefly and entirely coincidentally flying together. And I was offended. I said, what is this? What are they doing in our demonstration? This is our space, because the Poles are certainly not our friends. And I wonder if Polish Americans at that demonstration felt the same way about suddenly finding themselves on the same street behind the same police barricades with Jewish demonstrators. And in retrospect, that moment was exactly right, because these were the two most active forces that were, at least in the West, that were opposing Soviet communism. It was the Polish emigres, and then later, of course, the Polish Pope, and the Jewish demonstrators around the world who spent 25 years outside of Soviet embassies protesting. Now, what I understand, and perhaps understood even then, in my trip to Poland, was that it was no coincidence that the beginning of the collapse of the Soviet Union began here. And it began with the Polish Pope. It began a year, it began 1989, really began in 1978 with the election of Pope John Paul. And one of the people that I met here in Krakow, I went to the Catholic Intellectuals Club, was one of my stops here in the city. And I met a man who tried to explain to me what happened in Krakow when Pope John Paul came here and gave a mass in an open field for with a million people under communism. And he said to me, he had tears in his eyes, and he said to me, the Pope said, let the Holy Spirit descend on this field. Let the Holy Spirit descend now. And as he conveyed that to me, I felt the hairs on my arms rising. And I felt the power of what he was conveying of that moment. And I had no doubt, listening to him, that the Pope had brought the Holy Spirit to Krakow. And that is really what ultimately defeated Soviet communism. Now, John Paul, of course, is known and loved within the Jewish people for the Jewish revolution that he brought to the Catholic Church. And many Jews to this day regard the Polish Pope as something of an aberration. That, yes, he loved the Jewish people despite the fact that he was Polish. And I'll have more to say about that soon, how I learned something very different here. But a word first about the Jewish revolution that John Paul brought. Because Jews and Poles, I think, need some reminding at this moment exactly what John Paul did to try to heal this relationship. John Paul was the first pope to make the promise of Vatican II in its transformation of Catholic doctrine toward Judaism and the Jewish people. He was the first pope to make that explicit, to take the potential of that theological transformation and play it out in his inimitable public theatrical way, play it out on the world stage. And his message to the church and to the Jewish people was that Vatican II is the watershed. Vatican II means that according to church doctrine, not only are the Jews not responsible for the crucifixion, not only are the Jews not cursed, but the Jews are blessed. That radical transformation which happened under John Paul, of moving from the Jews as not being cursed to actually being blessed, and that the covenant, God's covenant, was not superseded by the church, but God's covenant remains in place with the Jewish people as well as the new covenant with the church. And we all remember John Paul's extraordinary visit to the Rome synagogue. But there is actually a deeper mission that he undertook. Anywhere in the world that he traveled, he made sure to meet with the local Jewish community. When he went to Cuba, toward the end of his life, he made sure to meet representatives of the 1,500 Jews who lived in Cuba. And if you ask yourself why did he bother every stop, met with the Jewish community? I think he was sending a message, first of all, to his own faithful, which is the relationship has to change. And he was sending a message to the Jewish community, which is you need to also start rethinking our historic relationship. So all of this is going on for me in October 1989. I'm suddenly realizing that I am at an extraordinary moment, first of all, in human history, in Polish history, in Jewish history, and potentially in the relationship between Poles and Jews. But meanwhile, I had an assignment from the newspapers that I was writing for to write about the Polish convent, to write about the Auschwitz convent. I was stuck with that assignment. And luckily, I made some new friends, immediate friends, who have remained ever since really lifelong friends, in Warsaw, Staszek and Monika Krajewski, who are here today and who became grandparents 2 days ago for the first time, and Mazal Tov. You didn't think it would be a private celebration, did you? And I went to see them, and I had read an interview with Staszek in an American Jewish magazine called Moment, sometime in the 1980s, a terrific magazine, with this crazy mathematician in Warsaw who discovered Judaism. And he and Monika discovered Judaism together and returned to their Jewish identity, actually through Monica's work with Jewish cemeteries. Monika photographed Jewish cemeteries around Poland, discovered Jewish culture and tradition, Judaism, Jewish values, through the markings of the cemetery on the tombstones. And so I figured I have to go look these people up. And there was this really instant love and friendship. And I said to them, I have this story that I have to write about the Auschwitz convent. I'd like to try to understand the convent, not only from a Jewish point of view, which I well understand as the son of a survivor, but I'd like to try to understand what the convent means. How do Poles see it? And so Staszek said to me, go speak to Poles, go speak to people in the church who have publicly taken the Jewish position that the convent has to be moved. Go speak to them and ask them, as Catholics, what does the convent mean to you? And it was a brilliant idea, because what Staszek understood is that I would be able to hear a Polish argument from Poles, a Polish argument over the convent, from Poles who were sympathetic to the Jewish position. And so I met with journalists. I met with a journalist, Szlewinski, who was a well-known journalist who I think worked for Catholic media. And I went to the, as I said earlier, the Catholic Intellectuals Club in Krakow. And I began to understand what I hadn't understood before, which is that Auschwitz was actually two places. There was Auschwitz I and Auschwitz II. Auschwitz II is Birkenau. Auschwitz I was a concentration camp, not necessarily for Jews. And in Auschwitz I, 70,000 Poles, again, the elite of Polish society, were murdered there. Auschwitz II is what Jews call Auschwitz for shorthand, Birkenau. And that is the graveyard, the Jewish graveyard. And when I began to realize that there was something here that we in the Jewish world had missed, I felt this urgency to tell that story. And I began I took Staszek's advice, and I asked Catholic Poles who had taken the Jewish side because their argument to the church was, if this convent is causing so much pain and anger, then it's not worth it. It should be moved. That was their argument to Polish society. And of course, eventually, the Pope himself endorsed that argument. And I asked them, what does it mean to you to have nuns praying in Auschwitz I? And they expressed such profound piety and such a sense of how significant it was for them to know that prayer is happening in that place, that I came to feel that in principle the convent belonged there, but in practice, if this convent is causing so much bitterness at that place, then it should be moved. But I came to feel very strongly that Poland had the right to build a convent on that site, which, as you can imagine, or maybe the Jews here could certainly imagine, was not a very popular position in the Jewish community in 1989. But I wrote a series of pieces for Jewish media in the United States. I was their correspondent at the time, and tried to explain the Polish position. Now, I mentioned earlier that my father was a survivor, but I would like to play that out a little bit at this moment to just give you a sense of how out of character this was for me to take a Polish Catholic position against the Jewish community's position. I grew up hearing from my father that when Christians speak about love, they mean everyone but the Jews. And growing up, when I would see a church, I would literally cross the street when I was a kid. A church was a place of menace and hatred. For me, seeing a crucified Jesus was seeing a dead Jew hanging on a cross, and imagining how that plays out in the Christian imagination. I gravitated toward the most right-wing Zionist groups. Again, the Jews in the audience might know Beitar, which was the youth movement of Jabotinsky and Menachem Begin. And then I graduated to Meir Kahana, who was really the Jewish Defense League, the most right-wing militant Jewish groups. And I was raised by my father to see myself as a kind of vicarious contemporary of the survivor generation. My father tried to raise me in a way where I would look at the world through his eyes. I would experience my life as an American-born Jew as if I had somehow gone through the Holocaust. That was really my father's educational mission. And he more or less succeeded through my teenage years. And it began breaking down in Poland. This was the beginning of the unraveling of my life as a vicarious Holocaust survivor. Now, one more thing happened to me in Poland, which I must say, happened in this city. One of the people that I met, who I went to interview, was someone, the Poles here I think will know the name, Father Giertych. Father Giertych at that time was the master of students, I believe that was the title, at the Dominican priory here. And he was in charge of the students who were becoming monks. And he comes from a well-known Polish family. Polish Jews of the pre-war generation will know the name because his father was one of the leaders of the anti-Semitic party in Poland. And I went to see Father Giertych. A friend had sent me there. And he was not especially sympathetic to the Jewish position. I'd say he was coming really from a pretty mainstream Catholic Polish attitude. But at the end of our, I would say, not easy conversation, He surprised me and invited me to come meet with his students at the Dominican monastery. And he said, you know, they've never met a Jew before. They've never met anyone from Israel. Remember, this is October 1989. And he said, come, it'll be interesting for all of us. Maybe it'll be interesting for you too. And so I went, and we spent close to 3 hours together. And they asked me any and every question imaginable. And then I asked them questions. And at the end, we prayed together, Psalm 23. They asked me, Father Giertych asked me to lead us in prayer. And I said, well, as a Jew being in this city a few hours from Auschwitz, let's pray together Psalm 23. Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. And we did. And that really was the moment. That was my first interfaith experience. Now remember, I had grown up crossing the street as a boy if I would pass a church. And here I am inside a monastery praying together with future monks. As a result of that experience and subsequent trips to Poland, one of those trips was organized by my friend Teresa, who's in the audience. It was an extraordinary experience where the Polish government, it was an official invitation to Israeli writers and artists to come to Poland and create your own trip. It was like a dream trip. And Teresa said to me, what are you interested in? And so I said, well, first of all, I'm interested in Polish Catholicism. And so I came back from that trip loaded with books and CDs of Polish liturgical music, which I still listen to. And more deeply, what changed for me was my writing life. I began writing about interfaith issues, first Christian-Jewish and then Muslim-Jewish. I wrote a book in 2001 called At the Entrance to the Garden of Eden, which was about a journey that I took into Christianity and Islam in Israel and the Holy Land. It's about crossing borders, crossing spiritual borders. And it's really about spiritual curiosity. And curiosity is a very dangerous trait because you never know where you're going to end up. You can end up sitting in a Polish monastery praying together with monks. And in this book, in the journey that I took into Islam and Christianity, I went as far as praying in a mosque in a Gaza refugee camp, which today is, for an Israeli, it's inconceivable. It's a kind of a death sentence to even imagine going there. And yet, that was my experience. And it was born for me. It would never have been possible if I hadn't made that breakthrough here in this city. Now, what does all of this mean? For me personally, I know what it means. It really changed my life. But what does it mean? What does 1989 mean for us? What does 1967 mean for Israel? I take some comfort in the story of the golden calf, the biblical story of the golden calf. Because when I look at this moment, which is really the antithesis of 1989 in many ways, we've fallen so low from that peak experience. And I think about that moment in the desert 3,500 years ago. And what to me is so extraordinary and paradoxically hopeful about the story of the golden calf is that the golden calf came right after the peak moment of revelation. The people of Israel are standing in front of the mountain. They have just experienced the presence of God. The Midrash, the rabbinic kind of literary, imaginative commentary on the Torah, on the Bible, says that the most common person among the people of Israel experienced a greater sense of revelation and prophecy than the greatest prophets. And then Moses doesn't come down for 40 days, and the people of Israel forget revelation, and they proceed to then violate the second commandment. They build a graven image right after the revelation. And so what that story tells us, the reason that I take comfort in it, is that ruptures in history, these moments of miracle in history, are not sustainable. You experience the possibility of radical transformation, but then the long-term work is to integrate it, and that, look, the people of Israel wandered the desert for 40 years, and that whole generation that experienced the Exodus, the splitting of the sea, the giving of the Torah, that whole generation had to disappear. And so we are in year 30 of maybe year 4 of the 40-year period. We are in the protracted period of trying to figure out how do we integrate that peak moment of 1989. And I think that what's crucial for us to remember is that 1989 was actually not an illusion. It was actually not a fleeting moment. In the way that I think revelation at Sinai was not a fleeting moment. It was a transformative moment, but it takes decades or centuries to play out. This moment, in terms of the relationship between Poles and Jews, in some ways echoes back to that terrible moment in the relationship of the Auschwitz convent. A moment where once again we are looking at reality in totally opposing ways. And my reading is that there really is enough blame to go around on both sides. The latest round that began with my foreign minister Katz, Israel Katz, who made his just unthinkable remark about Polish anti-Semitism, Poles imbibing anti-Semitism with their mother's milk, which of course is a statement that former Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir made in the 1980s, who was born in Poland and was a survivor. And maybe it was somehow understandable for his generation. It's certainly not understandable for my generation. And on the Polish side, the attempt to suppress objective research on the Shoah, the unbearable incidents, the burning of the effigy, of the Jewish effigy, in a land where millions of Jews were burned. This really hits Jewish sensibilities in the rawest places. The talk about 6 million Poles being murdered, which drives us insane. And so, how do we move forward? How do we move past one more dysfunctional relapse in the ongoing melodrama of Polish-Jewish relations? My starting point would be with John Paul's legacy, because John Paul really is the Pope that Poles and Jews share. We love the Polish Pope. And we need to understand that the fact that he was such a profound friend of the Jewish people was not despite the fact that he was Polish, but because he was Polish. And this is something that on our side we need to absorb. And John Paul's legacy to Poles and Jews is really a kind of a commandment. It's a commanding voice. And I think that we need to stand before him and measure our words and deeds accordingly. The next step in trying to help heal this relationship is for Poles and Jews to own our historical victories, to understand that we are actually not victim peoples anymore. And this is something that is a profound challenge for our two peoples. But the good news is that we actually won. Poland and the Jewish people, the state of Israel, we are on the victor side of history. And I think that really requires us to adopt a certain largesse, a certain generosity of spirit, where we can begin to understand that we don't need to be in that small mode of fighting over who suffered more, who did what to whom, and to really just try to let go of something of that mentality, which is perhaps understandable for a traumatized generation, but much less understandable for our generation. Now, it's easier said than done, because both Poles and Jews, what we have in common is that we are both peoples of profound history. Our identity, far more than countries, peoples in the West, we are shaped by our past. We are not existentialist beings. We are peoples of history. And so the challenge for us is, how do we honor our history, but at the same time not dishonor our own experiences, this generation's experience, by taking the smallest lessons of our past and perpetuating it? And what I would say to Jews, I have one or two more points and then we can open for conversation. What I would say to my fellow Jews in terms of how to move forward in this relationship is to appreciate that the great threat to the Jewish people today is not coming from the old anti-Semitism. It's not coming from Jews have big noses and Jews have too much money. It's not that. And the Polish anti-Semitism that persists really is drawing on that old anti-Semitism. The great threat to the Jewish people today is anti-Zionism, which is a euphemism for anti-Semitism. It is for me, anti-Semitism is very simple. Anti-Semitism is taking the Jews and turning the Jews into the Jew, and the Jew becomes the symbol of whatever a given civilization defines as its most loathsome qualities. And so under pre-Vatican II, pre-Holocaust Christianity, the Jew as Christ killer. Under Soviet communism, the Jew is capitalist. Under Nazism, the Jew as race polluter. And in our time, where human rights is becoming the culture, the global culture to some extent, where the greatest sin possible is to be racist, to be an apartheid state, the symbol of racism becomes, surprise, the Jewish state. Now, that's certainly true in Western Europe, increasingly. It is still not true in Poland. This is one of the few places in Europe where you can have a Jewish cultural festival that celebrates Israeli culture publicly in the streets, on television, and there's no boycott. There's no call for a boycott. And I think Jews need to understand the significance of this festival and what it represents in terms of how we assess the meaning of who our enemies are and who our friends are. And finally, I would say that really what is so precious to me about this festival is that it is a lingering memory and a living connection to 1989. Janosch, you still here?
Yeah.
Janosz, you began this festival in 1988 with a kind of a preternatural intuition, almost a prophetic intuition, still under communism when it was semi-legal, semi-illegal, fair to say. And then suddenly, 1989, and this festival becomes an embodiment of the spirit of 1989. And so what I love about this moment, this festival, is that it's a reminder of the possibilities of these ruptures in history, that moment, that miracle moment. And it's a memory of the possibility in our relationship. And so Janosz and your amazing team, thank you. Thank you for what you're doing. Thank you for preserving something of 1989. And thank you for this annual festival of redemption. Dziękuję. So let's open. Do we have time for conversation? Okay. Is Deborah Lipstadt delighted to? I didn't see you in the audience. Delighted that you're here.
One of my volunteers, please come over here.
Go on, Deborah. Go on. That's a question.
Yossi, I appreciate and I love your work, and we're good friends. There's a butt coming, as you can tell. And I also think that the very existence of the festival in 29 years and its history is really significant, et cetera, et cetera. The one point where I sort of was brought up short was in your last...
I see where this is going.
As you know exactly where I'm coming. And that is your seeming soft pedaling. You know, when you soft pedal a bike, it falls over. Your soft pedaling of some of the more recent developments, particularly by the Polish government, mm-hmm. in terms of the history of the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. And I think you would agree with me in saying that you don't play with history, whatever the reasons. You know, let's downplay this point because it'll, or let's avoid that point. You take history where it takes you. You can learn different things from it. But I think in the past year, year and a half, and Israel has been, the Israeli government has been complicit, and I use that word advisedly, in this, in terms of rewriting the history. It's what I call and have called publicly soft core Holocaust denial. I call it soft core because it's not denial of the facts, but it's a rewriting of the history, that Poles were strictly victims, etc., with lawsuits against very fine historians, some of whom will be presenting here, an action that generated a scathing denunciation from three of the most prominent historians at Yad Vashem. Yad Vashem, an Israeli government institution that never speaks out on history, with a scathing condemnation. I don't think that can be so easily, I don't think that should become the prism through which our entire view of the situation is refracted, but I think it's very dangerous in order to look for a kumbaya moment to overlook that.
So, first of all, I agree with you, and I appreciate the comment. I referred briefly, as it turns out, too briefly, to what is happening here in the last year and a half on the government side, and not only the government, large parts of the population. And I think you're right that we in Israel have a tendency to downplay the anti-Semitism that comes from the far right and the, I like that expression very much, the soft core Holocaust denial that's coming from our friends. And that's what makes it so complicated. And we in Israel are, I think, understandably to some extent, focused on anti-Zionism and on the delegitimization of Israel. But I think that's, and you've written and spoken about this, Deborah, in the last months, about the need to really, for Jews to hold together the assault and the renewal of anti-Semitism that's coming from both the right and the left. And there's a tendency among progressive Jews to only speak about the anti-Semitism coming from the right. You know, you always speak about the anti-Semitism in the other camp because it's easier. So yes, I appreciate that. And this, you know, it makes things very complicated. And to some extent, I really understand Netanyahu's overtures to the governments, the right-wing governments, the nationalist governments of Eastern Europe. But there's a terrible price that I think we're paying, which is in our integrity. And when Netanyahu, for example, went to Lithuania and praised the Lithuanian government for their Holocaust commemoration, that, to my mind, might have been one of the worst moments in his prime ministership, which is saying a lot. So yes.
To add one statement to that, you can't. I understand realpolitik, and he has realpolitik to deal with, but you can't praise the Lithuanians.
You can't praise the Lithuanians for being commemorators of the Holocaust. You can't praise Viktor Orban for being a lead fighter against anti-Semitism when he deals in overly anti-Semitic things, George Soros, etc. And you can't praise the Poles for their softcore Holocaust denial or say it's a great change, and at the same time claim, as Israel does, and Netanyahu is one of the first people to do that, to be the primary defender of the Jewish people in anti-Semitism.
Right.
You want to be the primary defender, then don't get into bed with the anti-Semites. Mm-hmm. You get into bed with the anti-Semites, don't claim you're the primary defender.
Yeah, you can take that further in terms of our internal Jewish dynamics. If you're going to call yourself the prime minister of the Jewish people, you can't effectively excommunicate the non-Orthodox Jewish denominations, but that fortunately is another conversation.
Thank you.
So thank you, Deborah. Thank you. I would just like to add one more point, just to really make it even stronger, which is it isn't, in terms of our relationship between the Polish people and the Jewish people, what is happening in Poland generally, the rise of anti-democratic trends, frightening rise of anti-democratic trends, even if they're not directly aimed against Jews, also has to impact our relations. And I say that as an Israeli, very mindful of the rise of anti-democratic trends that are happening in my country. And that so that's really an important context to emphasize. Hello again.
Hello. I would like to thank you very much for your lecture. You talk with the heart, with your feelings, and this is the most important. If the people want to talk to each other and would like to pass through the very difficult history moment, is the best way of doing it, to understand each other and to talk with the heart and not with the logic sometimes. That put me back to the previous lecture when your colleague from Israel said, you know, that there is a cure for messages from the God coming to Jerusalem saying you are the true one and they are not maybe Messiah, thank you. And maybe you are one, you know, maybe the right one. Thank you very much. It's really
thank you.
Hope that we are one people. We live together nearly for 1,000 years. And I feel it, even if I'm not Jew.
Thank you very much. Okay then, thank you. It was really a pleasure to be with all of you.